as much room as they could. They were lean and tough-looking, and like enough to be twins. Like the werewolf, they were very dark-skinned. Between skin tone, general build, and that grandpa, I was betting that they were all related. "You're Adam's army, buddy," I told the werewolf, trying to sound relaxed, like it made me think he might be on my side, like I didn't know that he'd been involved in the debacle at Adam's house. The one who was changed with him.
"Yes'm," he said. "David Christensen. These are my men, my grandsons, Connor and John Julian."
They nodded as he said their names. John Julian was rubbing his shoulder where I'd gotten a good grip with my teeth, and Connor was holding a wad of tissue to his nose with one hand while the other held my Kleenex box. "Mercedes Thompson," I told him. "What do you want?" David Christensen sat down on the floor, making himself as vulnerable as a werewolf could get.
"Well now, ma'am," he said, "we've gotten ourselves into something of a fix, and we're hoping you can help us out of it. If you know who I am, you probably know I've been a lone wolf by choice since the change."
"Yes," I said.
"I never finished high school, and the military was all I knew. When an old buddy recruited me for a mercenary troop, I was happy to go. Eventually, I got tired of taking orders and formed up my own troop."
He smiled at me.
"When my grandsons resigned their commissions and joined us, I decided to quit fighting other people's wars for them. We specialize in extracting kidnapped victims, ma'am. Businessmen, Red Cross, missionaries, whatever. We get them out of the hands of the terrorists."
My legs were getting tired, so I sat down on the back of the couch. "What does this have to do with me?"
"We find ourselves somewhat embarrassed," the werewolf said. "We're on the wrong side," said the man who'd answered to John Julian.
"Jerry Wallace came to you," I whispered, as if a loud noise would destroy my sudden comprehension. It was David's talking about being a lone wolf that had done it. Lone wolves and Dr. Wallace meant Jerry, the Morocco's liaison with Packless Wolves. "He told you that Bran intended to tell the world about the werewolves." No wonder Jerry was too busy to spend time with his father.
"That's right, ma'am," agreed David. He frowned at me. "You aren't a werewolf, I'd swear to it. So how do you know so much about us?"
He broke off his speech as a look of sudden comprehension came into his face.
"Coyote. You're the girl who turns into a coyote, the one raised by the Maroc."
"That's me," I said. "So Jerry talked to you about Bran's decision to bring the werewolves out into the public?"
"Bran is abandoning the wolves to the humans, just like the Grey Lords did their people," said Connor of the Bloody Nose.
My strangeness evidently took second place to his indignation toward Bran.
"He's supposed to protect his people. Someone needed to challenge him before he could do it."
"So you suggested Adam?"
"No, ma'am."
David's voice was mellow, but I bet if he'd been in wolf form, his ears would have been pinned against his skull.
"That was Jerry. He wanted me to come talk to him, one old friend to another."
"Bran is not one of the Grey Lords. He would never abandon his wolves. I suppose it never occurred to you to call Adam on the phone and talk to him, or even Bran for that matter," I said.
"We were just back from a mission," David said. "We had the time. Some things just work better in person."
"Like kidnapping?" I asked dryly.
"That was unplanned," Connor said, a touch of heat in his voice. "Was it?" murmured David. "I've been wondering. The whole thing came off so badly, with four of Jerry's wolves dead, that I can't help but wonder if it was planned that way."
"Three of his wolves dead," I said. "Mac was ours." David smiled, more with his eyes than his lips.
"Yes, ma'am. Three of his wolves died then, and one of Adam's."
"Why would he want to kill his own wolves?" asked Connor.
"We have to look at the wolves who died." David looked thoughtful. "I wonder if they were dominant wolves. I didn't know any of them well, except for Kara. She wouldn't have liked taking orders from Jerry for long. The boy, Mac, betrayed him by going to Adam for help."
"You make Jerry sound like a psychopath," said John Julian. "He didn't strike me as crazy."
"He's a werewolf," David told him. "We're a little more conscious of the chain of command than humans. If he wants to stay in control, he'd have to get rid of the wolves who were more dominant, and eventually, the wolves who betrayed the pack."
I looked at David. "I don't know Jerry well, but if I were to guess, I'd say you were dominant to him, too."
David grimaced. "I have my people. I don't want Jerry's. He knows that better than anyone. He's watched me for years." So he felt safe calling you in, I said tentatively, knowing you wouldn't challenge his leadership.
Jerry told Grandpa that Adam didn't want to challenge Bran, but he might listen to an old friend, said John Julian mildly. He offered to fly us out here to talk, so we agreed. It didn't take long before we realized matters were a little different than presented.
I'd made inquiries, David took over the narrative. I called friends and found out that Bran really does intend to tell the Alphas at the December meeting that he is going to take us public. So we came here to talk to Adam. I didn't think it would do much good. Adam likes the Marrok too much to challenge him.
But matters weren't quite as they were presented, said Connor. Jerry never told us he was assembling an army of mercenaries and werewolves.
An army? I said.
A small army. Two or three of the lone wolves like Kara who couldn't find a pack of their own, John Julian explained. And a small group of mercenaries, loners he apparently offered to turn into werewolves.
I should have put a stop to it when the damn fool armed a bunch of frightened idiots with tranquilizer guns.
David shook his head.
Maybe if I'd realized Jerry had come up with something that could hurt a werewolf. Anyway, from that moment on, it was a classic snafu.
Adam said they shot Mac when he opened the door, I said.
Jerry'd gotten them so worked up about how dangerous Adam was that before they even checked to see who it was, they shot him.
John Julian's voice held only mild regret, and I had a feeling that was mostly for the stupidity of the shooting rather than Mac's death.
Did you know Mac? I asked, looking down at Z's dagger, because I didn't want them all to know how angry I was. But of course, the werewolf knew.
No, they didn't, David said. We flew in last Monday afternoon.
He gave me an assessing look.
We were there when one of Jerry's mercenaries, a human, came in thoroughly spooked.
The man said someone killed his partner, said John Julian, looking at me too.
A demon.
No demons, I shrugged. It doesn't take a demon to kill an untrained newbie werewolf who was too stupid to live. I swallowed my anger. It wasn't their fault they didn't know Mac. I looked at them and hesitated. Maybe they should. My inclination was to trust them. Part of it was that their story rang true, though I didn't know them well enough to tell for sure. Part of it was remembering Adam's voice as he talked about David Christensen.
Let me tell you about Mac, the boy who died on my porch, I said.
Then told them about his change, the Chicago Alpha who sold him to Jerry, and the drug experiments.
All we saw were the trank guns, said John Julian slowly. But two shots killed the young wolf, and they shot at him with five before he was doped enough they could bind him. Our metabolisms are put out of commission by the silver while this DMSO carries a drug more quickly into our blood system? Asked David. Does that mean someone could just substitute something else for the ketamine?
I'm not a doctor, I told him. It sounded like something like that would work, though.
Maybe that's what it sounded like to Jerry, too, and he was testing it out, said David. With a real pack, it wouldn't have worked, but with a mix of lone wolf deviants and new wolves born of mercenaries who also have to work alone, there's no one who would feel it necessary to protect the prisoners.
That was nature's balance to the role of the dominant wolf. As strong as the instinct of wolves to follow those who were dominant was the instinct of dominance to protect those weaker than themselves.
All lone wolves aren't deviants, protested Connor.
David smiled. Thank you. But werewolves need packs. It takes something stronger to keep them away. A few are like me. We hate what we are too much to live within a pack. Most of them, though, are outcasts, men the pack wouldn't accept.
His smile changed, grew bleak.
I have my pack, Connor. It's just not a pack of werewolves.
He looked at me.
I left the other members of our team with Jerry to keep an eye on the situation there. There are six of us. A small pack, but it works for me. Most wolves who live very long outside of a pack go a little crazy. Mercenaries are a little the same way. A mercenary who only works alone usually does so because no one else will work with him because he's stupid or crazy, and the stupid ones are mostly dead.
Not someone I'd want to meet as a werewolf, I said as my phone rang. Excuse me a minute, I said, and fished around in my pockets for my cell, which had miraculously escaped damage.
Happy Thanksgiving, Mercy.
Happy Thanksgiving, Mom, I said. Can I call you back? I'm a little busy right now.
Your sister has just told us she's engaged,
said my mother blithely, ignoring me. So I sat and listened to her chatter about my siblings and my stepfather, while three mercenaries sat in my living room and watched me. Mom, I said when she showed signs of slowing down. Mom, I have company over.
Oh, good, she said. I was worried about you all alone on Thanksgiving. Is it Warren and that nice young man of his? I hope he keeps this one. Do you remember the last one? Easy on the eyes, I must say, but he wasn't someone you could have a conversation with, was he?
No, Mom, I said. These are new friends, but I have to go or they're going to feel like I'm ignoring them.
I hung up the phone gently a few minutes later. I forgot today was Thanksgiving, David said, but I couldn't tell if it bothered him or not.
I've been thinking about these drug experiments, sir, said Connor. Most men who are trying to assassinate a ruler intend to set themselves up instead.
These are werewolves, his grandfather said, not humans. Jerry could never be Marak. Oh, he's a dominant, but I doubt he'd ever be strong enough to be alpha of any pack, let alone all the packs. He knows that.
But does he like it? Asked Connor. Have you watched him among his wolves? Did you notice that the mercenaries he has who are still human show signs of being dominant? He tells them that he can't risk losing them right now, but I think he's being cautious. He doesn't like it when you give his wolves orders and they obey.
He can't change what he is, said David, but not like he was disagreeing.
No, sir, but he has Adam under his control now, doesn't he? Between finding the right combination of drugs and Adam's daughter, he could have Adam under his control all the time.
David tilted his head, then shook it. It wouldn't work, not for long. And Alpha would kill himself fighting before he'd submit for very long. He'd defeat the drugs or die.
I wasn't so certain. I don't think anyone knew exactly how the drug cocktails would work. Not even Jerry, who had been experimenting with new wolves and not powerful ones like Adam.
It doesn't matter what we think. Could Jerry believe they would work on Adam? Asked John Julian.
For some reason they looked at me, but all I could do was shrug. I don't know, Jerry. He didn't spend much time with the pack, and he traveled a lot with his job. I hesitated. Bran wouldn't put a stupid person in a position like that. David nodded.
I never thought Jerry was stupid before this, but that bloodbath has had me rethinking my opinions.
Look, I said, I'd love to discuss Jerry. But why don't you tell me what you are doing here and what you want from me first?
I still don't like what Bran's doing, David rumbled. Not at all. But I like what Jerry is doing even less. Jerry asked us to deliver the boy's body to your doorstep, explained John Julian. He said that you needed a warning to stay out of wolf business. We met him back at the house he was using for headquarters, and that was when we found out that he'd kidnapped Adam's daughter and left three of his wolves to die.
You don't leave your men behind, said Connor.
You don't attack the innocents, John Julian told me. It sounded like a creed.
David gave me a half smile.
And though I think Bran needs to be brought up short, only a fool would think he could get Adam to move a step he doesn't choose to. I'd leave Jerry to learn his lesson, but our honor is at stake. We don't hurt the innocents, so we're getting Adam and his daughter away tonight.
They have Adam? It wasn't really a surprise. What else could have kept the pack away from phones all day? It was even a relief to know because there had been a dozen other worse things that had occurred to me. What did come as a surprise was a door opening, though I hadn't sensed anyone on my front porch. Samuel, back in his human shape, let himself into my house. He was wearing only jeans. Even his feet were bare, and he limped a little as he came to me.
"They have Adam," he confirmed.
I might not have heard him or smelled him, but David didn't look surprised. He'd made a subtle gesture that kept his men where they were, though I could see they were tense and ready to act. "David Christensen, meet Dr. Samuel Cornick," I said. "Samuel, this is David, Adam's old army buddy. He's here to get Adam and Jesse out."
"So I heard," Samuel said, sitting down on the couch next to my feet.
"What happened to you?" I asked.
"We got to the address we had for the other wolves and found a few signs, but nothing definite. We wandered around quite a while before Daryl realized the reason Adam wasn't recalling us from the hunt was because he was gone, along with his car. Someone saw him with a cell phone, which he didn't have when we left Warren's house. Several wolves noticed the car drive away, but no one thought to question Adam."
"Wait a minute," I said, because I was getting a very bad feeling. "Wait a minute. The vampires would have checked out the address. Bran says there's nothing more paranoid than a vampire. They'd have made certain there were wolves where they were supposed to be, don't you think? Even just to make certain that it was wolves who'd come. But when half our pack shows up, they can't find enough scent to track the others?" I looked at David. And when Mac's body was left on my porch, I couldn't scent anyone else who shouldn't have been there. I didn't smell you. I hunched my shoulders. I should have realized it then, shouldn't I? It's not just Jerry, is it? I saw Samuel stiffen and remembered he hadn't known. Jerry Wallace is working with our witch. There were a lot of witches who could sterilize a body so that not even the keenest nose or the best-equipped, best-trained forensics team could find a clue. But Elizaveta Arkadyevna was one of the few witches who could have removed the scent of David and his men without removing the scent of Adam's house.
There's a Russian witch, David said.
If the wolf packs come out into the open, witches will lose a lot of business, I said. Staying hidden bears a high price, and the witches are some of the people who benefit. I'm not even certain it would be a breach of contract, not so long as Jerry wants to make Adam the Marak.
What?
Samuel's voice was so quiet it made me nervous. Jerry doesn't want the wolves to be made public, I explained. He decided Adam is the only one who can prevent it, by killing Bran. He held up a hand, his eyes cool as they watched the other men.
I think that Mr. Christensen should tell me what he believes is happening.
So Samuel could see if he was lying or not. Samuel was one of the wolves who could do that. David knew it, too. I could see it in his smile.
Jerry Wallace told me that Bran was abandoning his people. He asked me if I would speak to Adam and see if I could get him to object.
Meaning fight the Marak for leadership, clarified Samuel.
Yes. To that end, he flew me and my boys out here. I was surprised at the method he chose. I would not have brought armed men to confront an alpha in his own home, but I could not object more strongly without a fight that would have left me in charge of Jerry's wolves, and a sadder bunch of wolves you've never seen. I knew that Adam was capable of defending himself, so I went along with it.
David shrugged.
Talking to Ms. Thompson, we pretty much decided that Jerry intended that blood be spilled, because the wolves who died would have been trouble for him. I think he intended blackmail rather than talk from the beginning.
Samuel inclined his head.
He knows Adam. Adam wouldn't challenge my father, even if he disagreed with what Bran was doing. He doesn't want to be Marak.
He doesn't know Adam very well if he thinks he can control him by threatening his daughter, said David.
I think you're wrong, I said. I think Adam would do anything to save Jesse.
You all sound as if it is a given that Adam would kill my father.
I considered that. Jerry's the one who believes it. Maybe he intends to do something to ensure Bran's death. He still thinks that he's the only one who knows about the tranquilizers. Samuel growled, and I patted him on the top of the head. The back of the couch wasn't as comfortable as the seat, but I liked being taller than the two werewolves. Samuel pulled my hand down to his shoulder and held it there.
So why did you come here? He asked David. Couldn't you find Adam's pack?
I wasn't looking for the pack, David said. Jerry's got Adam drugged to the gills. I went in to talk to him, and he almost tore through his chains. From what he said, he thinks he's got a traitor in his pack. I think he's right. I suspect that's how they took him. Even so, I think the drug is making him more paranoid. Getting him out safely with his human child is going to require his cooperation. He doesn't trust me, and I'm sorry to say he has reason.
He looked at Samuel.
I don't think he'll trust you either. Not another male when his daughter is there.
He turned back to me.
But you have his scent all over your van, and he has a picture of you in his bedroom.
Samuel gave me a sharp look.
In his bedroom?
It was news to me, too. But I was more worried about Adam and Jesse than a picture. All right, I said. Where are they holding him? With two exceptions, Samuel didn't seem to have a problem letting David make all the plans. First, Samuel insisted on calling in the wolf pack, though he agreed they were only to be backup, waiting a few minutes away. Only Daryl would know what was up until the very last minute. He also insisted on calling his father and telling him what we knew.
Adam won't fight him, Samuel told David's frozen face. I know he doesn't like coming out, but he understands my father's reasons.
He sighed.
Look, none of us are happy about it, not even the Marak. But my father has had several wolves report that one of the government agencies is threatening them with exposure if they won't cooperate.
Some expression crossed David's face too quickly for me to read, but Samuel nodded.
I wondered if someone had talked to you, too. The others were all military. We've become an open secret, and that's not safe. Frankly, I'm surprised that Brand's managed to keep us hidden this long. I thought that once the public accepted the Fae, they'd discover all of us.
They didn't want to know, I said. Most of them like their safe little world.
What will your father do to Grandpa? Asked Connor.
Samuel raised his eyebrows.
I can't think of anything he's done wrong. He's sworn no oaths to Bran or anyone else, nor done anything to betray our secrets. Just the opposite.
My cell phone rang again. It was Bran. That werewolf was uncanny.
Mercedes, let me speak to my son.
I looked at Samuel and said, He's not here. I told you earlier that I haven't heard from him since last night.
Enough games, Bran told me. Give the phone to Samuel.
Raising my eyebrows at David Christensen and his men, I handed the phone over and listened to Samuel explain matters. Bran had probably heard the lie in my voice when I told him Samuel wasn't here. Probably. But David, who had heard both sides of the conversation, was going to be forever convinced that the Morak knew that Samuel was sitting beside me. I hid my satisfaction. The more powerful the wolves believed Bran, the safer he was. Chapter 14 We rode with Christensen and his grandsons for most of the way, me as human and Samuel in wolf form. He'd shifted again at my house because other wolves can sense the change. David dropped us off about a mile from the site with directions on how to get there. The idea was for me and Samuel to sneak up on our own. Then I'd see if I could wriggle my way through a hole in the side of the warehouse where Adam and Jesse were being kept, and Samuel would rendezvous with Adam's pack and wait until they were called in. Adam and Jesse were being held at a tree farm, nestled in the rolling lands just south of Benton City, a small town about 20 minutes outside of Richland. Though the tree farm was closed, there were still acres of trees unharvested. I recognized various maples and oaks as we passed, as well as a few pines. A huge pole building, obviously the warehouse David had told me about, was nestled well behind the manufactured home. The house was boarded up, and there was a realtor sign beside it, proudly proclaiming it sold. Samuel at my side, I crouched in a ditch surrounded by a thicket of Russian olive and gave the place a good looking over. From where I sat, I couldn't see any vehicles, so they were probably all parked on the other side of the warehouse. Christensen had told us that the tree farm had been purchased by a local winery that intended to use the land to grow grapes. Since they wouldn't plant until the coming spring, the whole thing, house and warehouse, was supposed to be empty until then. The realtor's sign told me that one of Adam's wolves had indeed betrayed him, and gave me a name. I pulled out my cell phone and called Daryl's number. By this time, I had it memorized. Have you gotten in touch with John Cavanaugh yet? I asked.
John Cavanaugh was one of the wolves I didn't know very well. He'd been at Warren's for our Council of War.
We haven't been able to locate him.
I heaved a sigh of relief that Daryl ignored, still lost in his irritation at not being told exactly what we were doing. He wasn't happy at having to follow Samuel's orders either.
As instructed, I'm not leaving messages on answering machines. That means we are going to be short a lot of people.
I'm looking at John Cavanaugh's name on a realtor's sign outside of the tree farm where they're holding Adam, I told him. There was a long pause.
I see, he said thoughtfully, and hung up.
Not one for long goodbyes, our Daryl, but a smart man. John Cavanaugh wouldn't be called for this rescue, or any other. Maybe it should have bothered me more that I had just signed a man's death warrant, but I'd wait and see how Adam and Jesse came out of it before I felt sorry for Cavanaugh. Beside me, Samuel whined softly.
All right, I told him, and began disrobing. It was cold out. Not as cold as Montana, but too chilly to do anything but fling clothes off as fast as I could, while being careful not to stick myself on the Russian olive thorns. I folded my clothes somewhat haphazardly and turned off my cell phone.
You don't have to wait for me to get in, I told him again. He just stared at me. I heaved a put-upon sigh, then I shifted. Delightfully warm again, I stretched, wagged my tail at Samuel, and headed out for the warehouse. It was still daylight, so I took a circuitous route to avoid being seen. I was aware of Samuel trailing me, though I never saw him.
quite impressive considering his coloring. White is good for a Montana winter, but winter in eastern Washington is usually gray and brown. One corner of the aluminum side of the warehouse was bent up, just a little, right where Christensen had told me it would be. I had to work at it, but I got inside at the cost of a little fur. My nose told me that another coyote and several smaller critters had used the same route within the past few months. If Jerry or one of his wolves caught my scent, hopefully they'd just think another coyote had gotten in. The interior of the warehouse was cavernous and no warmer than it had been outside. Somehow, though Christensen had said I wouldn't have any problem finding a place to hide, I'd expected it to be empty. Instead, it was filled with hundreds, maybe thousands of crates, pallet-sized with 3-foot-tall plywood sides warped by moisture and wear. The crates were stacked 3 high on racks that reached to the ceiling maybe 30 feet over my head. The air smelled musty. As I looked around, I saw there was a sprinkler system set up and drains in the floor. It made sense, I suppose. When the warehouse was full of trees, they would have had to keep the plants moist somehow until they shipped them. I found a stack whose bottom crate bore a sheet of paper that said Hamamelis virginiana, witch hazel, 3 to 4 feet. It was empty, but the astringent smell of the shrub still clung to the gray wood. I could have hidden inside the top crate, but I'd be easy to see while I was jumping in or out. Instead, I curled up on the cement between the bottom crate and the metal exterior wall, as safe as I could be under the circumstances. The plan was for me to wait for one of David's sons to come and get me. They were going to do the extraction, David's words, at night, which was still a few hours away. Jerry had been having problems with Adam. Even with the tranquilizer, they'd found that having guards in the room they were keeping him in made him too agitated. They remembered the way he'd broken through their restraints at his house, so they did their best to keep him calm. That meant most of the time he and Jesse were alone with a guard outside the room. Jerry's scent bothered Adam enough that he'd had to stay out of the warehouse entirely. Although we weren't getting Jesse and Adam out for a few hours, I could go in with him and do my best to get Adam ready to be rescued. We'd argued about that. David had wanted me to wait until his man was on guard duty near dusk, but I didn't want to leave Adam and Jesse alone any longer than they had to be. David thought the risk of discovery was too high. Samuel settled the argument.
Let her go. She's gonna do it anyway, and this way we can reduce the risks.
David hadn't been happy, but he'd bowed to higher authority and better judgment. Samuel was right. I wasn't about to let Adam and Jesse wait around without protection when I could be there with them. Jerry was the only wolf who would know my scent, and he was staying away from the warehouse. All the other wolves would just assume I was a coyote, and there were lots of coyotes around. I still had to wait for escort, though, which might be a long time coming, but it was safer than having me wander around looking for where they were hiding Adam and Jesse. It is impossible to stay in the state of readiness while waiting motionless. Eventually, I fell into a light doze that lasted for maybe an hour before the newly familiar smell of John Julian woke me. I crept out cautiously, but he was alone, with my pack over one shoulder. He didn't talk to me, just turned and threaded his way through the crates to a section of the warehouse that looked as though it had been offices. Like the crates, they were stacked one atop the other, 3 high. He climbed the stairs to the middle tier, where the far door had a bright and shiny deadbolt lock that made it stand out from the others. When he turned the bolt and opened the door, I darted inside and stopped. No wonder Jerry left them with only one guard at a time. There was no chance either Jesse or Adam would escape on their own. Jesse was lying on a bare mattress. Someone had wrapped duct tape around the lower half of her face, covering her mouth, hair, and neck. Getting it off was going to be a nasty business. Handcuffs held her wrists together, and a climber's rope secured the handcuffs to the 2x4 bed frame. Her ankles were bound together and tied to the foot of the bed, making it impossible for her to do much more than wiggle. She stared at John Julian with dull eyes, and didn't seem to notice me at all. She was wearing pajamas, probably what she'd been wearing when they'd taken her, those soft cottony plaid things with a t-shirt top. On the white underside of her left arm was a bruise so dark it appeared black rather than purple. Adam was seated in a chair obviously made by the same style-impaired carpenter who'd thrown together the bed frame. It was crude, made of 2x4s and lag bolts, though I don't suppose they were worried about style. Heavy manacles, just like something you'd expect in a wax museum or medieval torture chamber, held his wrists onto the chair arms, and a second set held his ankles to the chair legs. But even destroying the chair wouldn't free him, because there were enough silver chains wrapped around him to have funded the local school system for a year.
"Jerry won't come here," said John Julian to me.
Adam opened his eyes just a bare fraction, and I saw that his irises were yellow gold and blazing with rage.
"His presence has the same effect on Adam that my grandfather's does. Not even the drugs are enough to keep Adam calm, so Jerry will stay away. Our man is only on guard for another 5 minutes. The next one is the enemy, but after that, Sean, one of our men, takes over for a 2-hour shift."
John Julian continued giving me information I already knew, repeated to make sure I understood.
"Sean will come in to help you as he can. The guards are supposed to stay downstairs except when they first come on shift, but you need to leave both of them bound until Sean takes over guard duty in case they don't. There's one guard watching the prisoners, and there are 4 men on patrol over the property. One of those is supposed to just walk around the outside of the warehouse. There's electricity and satellite TV in the house, so most of them are in there when they're not on duty. No one really expects Adam's pack to find them this soon, so they're not on high alert."
David's men were doing the lion's share of guarding the prisoners because Jerry didn't have many people he could trust with a helpless 15-year-old girl, that not being a talent much in demand in the world of crazy mercenaries and lone wolves. David said that Jerry had paid them to stay and work guard duty. Jerry seemed to believe that David wouldn't work against him as long as he was paying them. While John Julian was talking, I glanced around the room, which wasn't exactly bursting with places to hide. As long as they didn't come all the way in, I could conceal myself behind the door or in the big sliding door closet. Some clichés are clichés because they work. There was no reason for the guards to search the room as long as Adam and Jesse were still there. Jesse finally stirred as she realized he wasn't talking to her. She twisted awkwardly until she got a good look at me, then made a harsh noise behind her gag. "Shh," he told her, then said to me,
"You've got about 4 hours. We'll create a diversion. Not my job, but you'll know it when you hear it. Your job is to get these two down the stairs and into the room nearest the big garage door. Grandpa will find you there, and we'll escort you out."
I nodded, and he set the pack he carried on the floor.
"Good luck," he said quietly, and left, locking the door behind him.
I shifted as soon as the door closed and opened the pack, pulling out underwear, a dark T-shirt, and a pair of old sweats. I dressed, put on my shoulder harness, and slid my SIG into it. It was chambered and ready to go. I brought my foster father's Smith & Wesson, too. It was too big for a shoulder harness, and I couldn't fire it as often, but the .44 Magnum bullets packed more punch than the 9mm. If everything went right, I wouldn't have need for either. I heard someone coming up the stairs and realized that I hadn't heard John Julian go down, which was pretty good for a human. Assuming that this was the new guard, I grabbed my pack and hid in the closet, the SIG, back in my hand. The closet had a sliding door, but I left the side farthest from the door open, just as it had been. I could see Jesse jerk against her ropes as someone turned the bolt and threw open the outer door.
"Hey, pretty thing," said the guard.
I could smell the garlic he'd eaten recently, and something unhealthy and sour. He wasn't a werewolf, but he wasn't anyone I particularly wanted around Jesse either.
"I'm here to take you to the bathroom. If you're nice to me, I'll even let you eat something. I bet you're hungry by now."
He walked over to Jesse, and I had a perfect shot at his back. The temptation to take it was made stronger by the panic in Jesse's eyes and the smell of fear that washed off her. Adam snarled, and the guard drew his gun and turned toward him. He pulled the trigger, and Jesse made a horrible, disbelieving sound. I had my gun out and was tightening my own finger when I realized that the gun had made a soft pop rather than a bang. It was an air-powered trank gun. If he'd had a werewolf's hearing, I'd have had to shoot him anyway because I couldn't help the gulp of air I'd taken when he shot Adam.
"That'll keep you for a while," he said, presumably to Adam.
He holstered the gun and bent over to work on the knots at Jesse's feet. If he turned around, he could have seen me, just as Jesse did. I shook my head at her and touched my eyes, then pointed at the guard. She got the point, because she quit looking at me, staring fixedly at the ceiling instead. He didn't seem to hear it, but someone was jogging up the stairs, possibly drawn by the sound of the gun's discharge, soft as it had been. The door was hanging open, so the second man came right in. This one was a werewolf. I couldn't see him, but I could smell him just fine.
"Smells like animals in here,"
he said in a voice that echoed in a bass so low that it sounded muffled. At first I was sure he was talking about me. The guard I could see jerked around, obviously caught by surprise. If he'd shifted his eyes 10 degrees, he'd have been staring right at me. But the second guard held his attention instead.
"You an animal, Jones?"
the second man asked with a soft eagerness in his voice.
"I am."
Jones backed up until the bed caught him behind the knees, and he sat down, half on top of Jesse. I could have told him that was stupid. You don't back away from predators. It gives them the wrong idea. When Jones didn't say anything, the werewolf laughed.
"I thought the boss told you he didn't want you anywhere near this child. Am I right?"
I don't know what the werewolf was doing, but it must have been frightening, because Jones was making small noises. The werewolf moved at last, a big red-headed man with a dark beard cut close to his face. He grabbed Jones, a hand on each shoulder of his shirt, and picked him up off the bed with a grunt of effort. He turned toward the door and tossed the lighter man across the room. I didn't see Jones hit the floor, but I heard him gasp.
"Go,"
the werewolf said. I heard Jones scramble down the stairs, but I wasn't certain that it was an improvement. The man who was left was far more dangerous. He'd made that remark about animals. Had he scented me, or was he just taunting Jones? I stood motionless, except for a slight tremor I couldn't control, and tried to think good thoughts. Fear is a strong scent, and while Jesse was scared enough for the both of us, I was hoping to stay unnoticed.
"All right, Angel, let's get you untied,"
the werewolf said to Jesse in a gentle voice that might have been more reassuring if I hadn't been able to smell his lust. Jesse was unable to do so, and I saw her relax fractionally. His big hands made short work of the knots, and he helped her sit up like a gentleman, giving her time to work out the stiffness in her shoulders and back. She, smart girl that she was, positioned herself so that his gaze was away from the closet. He gave her a gentle boost so she could stand, then steadied her with light hands as she walked out of my view and out the door. I leaned against the wall, closed my eyes and prayed I'd made the right decision, that he wasn't going to do anything more than take her to use a restroom. In the meantime, I needed to check on Adam. The dart was still stuck in his neck, and I pulled it out and dropped it on the floor. He opened his eyes when I touched him, but I don't think he saw anything. "It's all right now," I told him, rubbing gently at the bloodstain on his neck. "I'm here, and we're going to get you and Jesse out. We know who at least one of the traitors is, and the rest won't be able to cause any harm." I didn't tell him who we encompassed. I wasn't sure he was hearing me anyway, but I wanted to soothe him rather than rile him. There was another dart tangled in the sleeve of his right arm, and I pulled it out, leaning across his body to do so. His head dropped forward until his face was buried between my shoulder and my neck. I couldn't tell if it had been a purposeful move on his part, or if I'd bumped him, but I could hear his breathing deepening. "That's right," I told him. "You sleep, and get rid of this poison." I stayed there holding him against me until I heard someone start up the stairs again. I rearranged Adam until he looked like he had when they'd left, minus the darts, then scrambled quietly back into my hiding place. I waited, worried, as a single set of footsteps came back up the stairs. It wasn't until he came into my view again that I realized the guard was carrying Jesse. She was stiff in his arms and staring at the wall.
"Sorry, Angel," he crooned as he tied her up efficiently. "I'd have given you privacy if it were up to me, but we couldn't chance it, could we?"
He was a dead man, I thought, memorizing his features and the way he moved so I'd know him again, even if Jerry happened to have 2 6-foot-plus red-headed giants in his pack. I'd heard the satisfaction in his voice, and I'm certain Jesse did as well. He wanted to scare her. Adam stirred. I could hear it, though he was out of my range of vision.
"Mercy,"
he said, his voice a hoarse rasp. The guard laughed.
"Mercy, is it? You'll find none of that around here."
He reached down and patted Jesse's face.
Until next time, Angel.
Adam called her Angel, I remembered, feeling a little sick. The door shut, and the bolt slid home. I waited until he'd gone back down before I moved out of the closet. Jesse was still staring at the wall. Adam's head had fallen forward again, and I couldn't help but touch him again to make sure he was still breathing. Then I went to his daughter. She hadn't altered her position since the guard had retied her. 2 hours before it was safe to release them, I thought, even while I was digging in the pack for something to cut Jesse's ropes. There was no way I could leave her like this for 2 more hours. I don't know why I brought Z's dagger with me, or why I reached for it instead of the pocket knife I'd also packed, but it came into my hand like it belonged there. Jesse jerked when I put a knee on the bed, so I touched her shoulder.
It's me, Mercy. No one's gonna hurt you anymore. We've got to wait yet, but we're going to get you out of here. You need to be quiet. If you can do that for me, I'll get this rope off you and see what I can do about the duct tape.
She'd gone from being utterly passive to shivering as if she were frozen as soon as I began talking to her. It was chilly in the room, and they hadn't covered her, so I suppose that might have been part of the problem. But she was sucking in air as hard as she could, a difficult task since she could only breathe in and out of her nose. I touched the edge of the dagger to my thumb. It was sharp, but not sharp enough to make cutting through climbing rope very easy. I slid the blade between a strand of the rope and the bed frame, and almost stabbed myself when I pulled back and there was no resistance. I thought at first that the dagger had slipped out from under the rope, but the rope was clean cut. I gave the dagger a look of respect. I should have realized that any dagger Z carried about as personal protection would have some surprises in store. I cut the rope at her feet, and she pulled her knees up to her chest and tucked her arms around her middle. Tears slid down her face, and I rubbed her back for a minute. When she seemed to be calming a little, I went back to the pack and pulled out a small, travel-sized can of WD-40.
Next to vinegar and baking soda, WD-40 is the miracle discovery of the age, I told her. Right now, we're going to use it to loosen up this duct tape.
I wasn't certain it would work, although I had used it to clean up duct tape residue on cars. But as the oil worked into the edge of the tape, I was able to peel it slowly off her skin. When enough of the tape was loose, I slid Z's dagger against the tape and cut through it close to her ear. I wasn't worried about freeing her hair just now. I only needed to get it off her face. It came up as nicely as any of the stuff I'd peeled off cars. It didn't take very long before her mouth was free, and I sliced the remaining tape so that all she had was a strip stuck in her hair.
"That tastes terrible,"
she said hoarsely, wiping her mouth with the bottom of her shirt. "I don't like it either," I agreed, having gotten the oil in my mouth a time or two when I forgot I had it on my hands. "How long since you had something to drink?"
"When they brought Dad in,"
she whispered to her knees.
"When I talked, he kept rousing from whatever they keep injecting him with, so they gagged me. I thought werewolves were impervious to drugs."
"Not this drug," I told her as I went back to my pack and pulled out the thermos of coffee, "though I don't think it's working as well as they want." "I should have thought to bring water," I told her, holding a thermos cup filled with the noxious-smelling black stuff near her face. I know that most people like the smell, but for some reason, I can't stand it. When she didn't move, I snapped,
"Come on now, you don't have time to wallow. Tonight, when you're home, you can go catatonic if you want to. You need to help me get your father up and running."
I felt like I was beating a whimpering dog, but she sat up and took the small metal cup in a trembling hand. I'd been expecting that and only filled the cup halfway. She grimaced at the taste.
"Drink it," I told her. "It's good for what ails you, caffeine and sugar. I don't drink it, so I ran over to your house and stole the expensive stuff in your freezer. It shouldn't be that bad. Samuel told me to make it strong and pour sugar into it. Should taste sort of like bitter syrup."
She gave me a small smile, then a bigger one, and plugged her nose before she drank it all down in one gulp.
"Next time,"
she said in a hoarse voice,
"I make the coffee."
I grinned at her. "That's it."
"Is there any way to get the handcuffs off?"
she asked.
"We've got a conspirator coming in a couple of hours," I told her. "He'll have keys."
"Okay,"
she said, but her mouth trembled.
"But maybe you could try to pick them. These aren't the good ones like cops have.
but more like the ones you find at BDSM stores.
Jessica Tamarind Hauptmann, I said in a shocked voice. How would you know about that? She gave me a watery giggle.
One of my friends has a pair he got at a garage sale. He locked himself in and couldn't find a key. He was pretty panicked until his mom picked the lock.
I took a good look at the keyhole. It looked suspiciously clumsy to me. I didn't have any handy bobby pins or wire hangers, but Z's dagger had a narrow point. I took one of the cuffs and tried to insert the narrow end of the dagger. First I thought it wasn't going to fit, but with a little pressure, it slid in just fine.
Ow!
Jessie jerked her arms. I pulled the dagger back and looked at the scratch on her wrist. Then I looked at the cuff, where the dagger had slid through the metal almost as easily as it had the rope.
Metal mage indeed, I murmured.
What kind of a knife is that? Jessie asked.
A dagger. A borrowed one. I set it against the chain between the cuffs and watched the chain melt away from the edge of the dark gray blade.
I suppose I'm going to ask more questions next time I borrow something from a fae.
Can it cut all the way through the cuffs?
Jess held up the damaged one, which was already half sliced through. I held it away from her bruised skin and cautiously slid the dagger between her wrist and the cuff. It looked like some bad special effect as the metal parted from the blade. A filmmaker would have added sparks or a bright red glow. All I could detect was a faint whiff of ozone.
"Who did you borrow it from?" she asked as I cut through the second cuff. "Z?"
I saw his status rise from crusty old friend to intriguing mystery.
"How cool."
She sounded almost like herself, and it was a painful contrast to the purpling bruise down one side of her face and the marks around her wrists. I didn't remember seeing the bruise on her face before the werewolf took her downstairs. "Did he hit you just now?" I asked, touching her cheek and remembering the sight of the guard carrying her while she tried to be as small as possible. She withdrew, the smile dying and her eyes growing dull.
"I don't want to think about him."
"All right," I agreed easily. "You don't need to worry about him anymore." I'd see to it myself if I had to. The veil of civilization fell away from me rather easily, I thought, taking the empty cup and twisting it back on the thermos. All it had taken was the sight of that bruise, and I was ready to do murder. "You really ought to have more of this," I told her. "But I need the caffeine for your father. Maybe Sean will bring something with him when he comes."
"Sean?"
I explained about David Christensen and the help they had promised in getting us all out in one piece.
"You trust them?"
she asked. And when I nodded, she said,
"Okay.
Let's go take a look at your father." Once I'd freed Jessie, there was little benefit to leaving Adam in chains, and all that silver couldn't be helping him any. I brought Z's dagger up to bear, but Jessie caught my hand.
"Mercy,"
she said in a small voice.
"When he starts coming out of it, he's..."
"Pretty scary?" I patted her hand. I thought a time or two that her experience with werewolves had led her to think of them like pets rather than dangerous predators. It looked as though that wasn't going to be a problem. I remember David saying that Adam had gone crazy when he'd come into the room, and I remembered the ruins of Adam's living room. Maybe the veil had been ripped from her eyes a little too thoroughly. "What did you expect when he's helpless in the hands of his enemies?" I said reasonably. "He's trying to defend you as best he can. It takes a tremendous amount of will to overcome the stuff they've been pumping into him. You can't expect the results to be pretty." I had been going to start with one of the chains, but Jesse's concerns made me realize that I was a little worried about completely freeing Adam, too. That would never do. Not if I was going to get him up and mobile. If I was afraid of him, it would rouse the predator. Resolutely, I pressed the knife against the heavy manacle that held his left wrist. I had to be careful, because the manacles fit his wrist tighter than the cuffs had fit Jessie. There was not enough space between his skin and the metal to slide the dagger in without cutting him. Remembering how the blade had reacted to cutting Samuel, I thought that might be a bad thing. So I let the knife rest on the metal without adding any force, so I could pull it away as soon as it was through. At first, I thought it was the heat of my hands warming the haft, but as the blade broke through the manacle, I had to drop it, because it had grown too hot to hold. Adam's hand slid off the chair arm to rest in his lap. It took almost an hour to cut away the rest of the manacles and chains.
Each time the knife heated up, it did so more quickly and took longer to cool off. There were scorch marks on the linoleum floor and a few blisters on my hand by the time Adam was finally free of the silver chains. Jesse helped me to gather all the chains together and heap them on the bed. We had to be careful not to drag them on the floor, because the sound of metal on hard surfaces tends to carry. We were just dropping the last of it when I heard the sound of the guard's footsteps on the stair. I dropped Z's dagger on the bed with the silver, pushed Jesse toward the closet, and drew my gun. I aimed it about 6 feet up the door and froze, waiting for the bolt to turn on the lock. He whistled as he inserted the key, and I steadied my grip. I planned on hitting him in the middle of his chest first, then 2 shots into his head. If he wasn't dead after that, he'd be incapacitated so I could finish him off. It would rouse everyone, but I had no options. I had neither time nor inclination to rebind the prisoners. As I drew in a breath, I heard a man's voice, distorted by the door and by distance, so I couldn't quite make out what he said. But I heard the man outside our door. If I had to kill someone, I was happy it would be the one who'd hit Jesse.
"Checking on the prisoners," he said. "It's about time to shoot Hauptmann again."
The second man said something else.
"I don't need orders to watch the clock," he said. "Hauptmann needs more of the drug. He's not going to kick the bucket over a little silver. Hang what Wallace says."
I sucked in my breath as power crept up the stairway. Not Adams or Samuel's caliber, but power nonetheless. And I guessed that the man talking to our guard was David Christensen. The guard growled, but he pulled the key out of the door and tromped down the stairs. I heard the sound of a short, nasty little argument, and when no one came back up the stairs, I decided Christensen had won his point and put my gun away again. "Well," I told Jesse as I tried to steady my breathing, "wasn't that fun?" She'd curled up in the bottom of the closet. For a moment, I thought she was going to stay there, but she was tougher than that. She gathered her courage and got to her feet.
"Now what?"
I looked at Adam. He hadn't moved. I crossed the room and put my hand against his face. His skin was cool to my touch, which was bad. Because of their high metabolisms, werewolves usually feel warmer to the touch. I wondered how much of that silver they'd pumped into his system. "I need to get some of that coffee into him," I told Jesse. "And I have some food, too, which should help." She stood by me and looked at him, then looked at me.
"Okay," she said finally. "I give. How are we going to get him to drink coffee?"
In the end, we dragged him out of the chair and propped his head up against Jesse's thigh. We dribbled the coffee, which was still hot, into his mouth. Neither of us could figure out how to make him swallow, but after a few dribbles, he did it on his own. After the third swallow, he opened his eyes, and they were night-dark velvet. He reached up and grasped Jesse's hand where it lay on his shoulder, but his eyes were on me.
"Mercy," he mumbled. "What the hell did you do to my French roast?"
I had a moment to believe all my worries had been for nothing, when he dropped Jesse's hand and his spine curled backward, throwing his head farther into her lap. His skin went gray, then mottled, as his hands clenched. His eyes rolled back until all I could see were the whites. I dropped the coffee and grabbed Jesse under the shoulders and dragged her away from Adam as far and as fast as I could.
"He'll hit his head,"
she said, beginning to struggle as she realized, as I had, that he was having a seizure. "He'll heal a cracked skull, but you can't," I told her. "Jesse, he's a werewolf. You can't go anywhere near him when he's like this. If he hits you, he'll break bones." I thanked the dear Lord sincerely that he'd let go of Jesse's hand before he crushed it. As if it had been awakened by the same demons that were causing his convulsions, I felt the sweep of power arise from him, as would any other werewolves in the area, which, if Christensen's figures were accurate, numbered 12. "Can you shoot?" I asked her.
"Yes."
Jesse didn't look away from her father. I pulled the SIG out and handed it to her. "Point this at the door," I said, digging to the bottom of the pack for the 44. "If I tell you to shoot, pull the trigger. The first pull will be a little stiff. It's loaded for werewolf. We have allies here, so wait until I tell you to shoot." I found the revolver. There was no time to check it, but I'd loaded it before I put it in the pack. That would have to do. The Smith & Wesson was a lot heavier than the SIG, and it could do a lot more damage.
"What's wrong?"
Jesse whispered, and I remembered she was human and couldn't feel the song of the Alpha's strength. The music grew, abruptly doubling, and the focus faded until I couldn't tell that it was coming from Adam anymore. Light feet ran up the stairs and the bolt turned on the door. Jesse was still looking at me, but I had my revolver up and aimed as the door opened. "Don't fire," I said, raising my gun and putting my hand on top of hers so that the automatic's nose stayed on the ground. "He's one of ours." The man who stood in front of the door had skin the color of hot chocolate, a green T-shirt that said, "Dragons killed the dinosaurs," and hazel eyes. It was the shirt that told me he was David's man. He was standing very still, giving us time to decide he was on our side.
"I'm Sean," he said.
Then he saw Adam.
"Damn," he said, stepping into the room and shutting the door quietly. "What's going on?" he asked, his eyes on Adam, who was flat on his back, his arms and legs doing a strange, jerky sort of dance.
"I think he's changing," Jesse answered.
"Convulsions," I said. "I'm no doctor, but I think that too much of the silver has worked its way into his nervous system and damaged something important."
"Will he be okay?"
Jesse's voice shook. "He's tough," I told her, hoping she wouldn't notice I hadn't answered the question. How much silver did it take to kill a werewolf? Usually it was a function of power, but there were some werewolves who were more sensitive to it than others.
"I was switching guard duty with Hamilton when the captain picked a fight with Connor and gave me the high sign to get my ass up here," Sean said. "I hadn't taken three steps when every werewolf on the place was converging on the captain. I take it that something about this fit called them all?"
I nodded and explained to both of them as best I could. "I don't know how Christensen is doing it," I told him, "but he's pulling Adam's power and muddying it. I bet everyone will think it's him."
"Because of the fight," Sean said, in an aha voice.
But I'd lost interest in how quick off the mark Christensen had been, because Adam quieted and lay limp. Jesse would have gone to him then, but I held her back. "Wait," I said, using the opportunity to take the automatic back from her so that she didn't fire it by accident. "Make sure he's finished."
"He's not dead?" she asked.
"No, I can hear him breathing." It was faint and shallow, but steady. I stowed the Smith & Wesson on the top layer in my pack and put the SIG back in its holster. Thanks to Christensen, we weren't going to have a pack of wolves converging on us, but that might change at any time. Adam hadn't moved, but his breathing grew deeper. I started to tell Jesse that it was all right, when Adam abruptly rolled on his side and jerked into a fetal position with a low groan. Chapter 15
"Now is he shifting?" asked Jesse.
"That would be bad," said Sean. "We don't want him changing until he's kicked off the effects of the drugs. I talked to some of the men who were in your house when he broke free. He was tranked up then, too."
"Stop scaring her," I snapped. "He'll be all right. Besides, I don't think he's changing." Actually, that werewolfy feeling of power had died to nothing. I had no idea what he was doing. The dress shirt Adam wore, dirty, torn, and stained with drops of blood, looked more gray than white. A lot more gray. He'd broken out in a sweat, and the fabric began to cling to him, outlining the taut muscles of his shoulders and back. I could even see the bumps of his spine. The shirt shimmered a little under the cold fluorescent lights as he shivered miserably. I couldn't tell if he was conscious or not. I holstered the revolver and walked slowly toward him. "Adam," I said, because he had his back to me. It is never a good thing to startle the werewolf. "Are you all right?" Unsurprisingly, he didn't answer. I crouched and touched the wet fabric, and he grabbed my wrist, his movement so fast that he was just suddenly there on his back. I don't remember seeing him roll over. His eyes were yellow and cold, but his grip was light. "You're safe," I told him, trying to stay calm. "Jessie's here, and she's safe too. We're going to get you on your feet in fighting shape, then we're getting out of here."
"It's the silver," said Sean, awed. "That's why the shirt is turning gray. Damn. Damn! He's sweating silver! Damn!"
Adam didn't look away from me, though he flinched subtly at the sound of Sean's voice. His blazing gold eyes held mine, somehow hot and icy at the same time. I should have looked away, but it didn't seem like a dominance contest. It felt like he was using my eyes to pull himself up from wherever the drugs had forced him.
I tried not to blink and break the spell.
Mercy.
His voice was a hoarse whisper. C'est moi, tis I told him. It seemed appropriately melodramatic, though I didn't know if he'd catch the reference. I shouldn't have worried. Unexpectedly, he laughed.
Trust you to quote Lancelot rather than Guinevere.
Both of them were stupid, I told him. Arthur should have let them marry each other as punishment and gone off to live happily on his own. I only like Camelot for the music. I hummed a bit. The mundane talk was working. His pulse was less frantic, and he was taking deep, even breaths. When his eyes went back to normal, we'd be out of trouble. Except, of course, for the small matter of a warehouse full of enemies. One trouble at a time, I always say. He closed his yellow eyes, and momentarily I felt cut adrift and abandoned, until I realized he was still holding my wrist as if he were afraid I'd leave if he let go.
I have the mother of all headaches, he said. And I feel like I've been flattened by a steamroller. Jessie safe?
I'm fine, Dad, she said,
though she obeyed the urgent signal I made with my free hand and stayed where she was. He might have sounded calm, but his scent and the compulsive way he was holding onto my wrist contradicted his apparent control.
Bruised and scared, I said, but otherwise unhurt.
I realized that I actually didn't know that and gave Jessie a worried glance. She smiled, a wan imitation of her usual expression.
Fine, she said again, this time to me.
His sigh held relief.
Tell me what's been going on.
I gave him a short version.